Proverbs chapter 31. Before we look a little more closely at each of these verses this evening, I want to begin by reading this last section in its entirety, just to kind of give us an overview. In fact, as you're going over there to this passage, let me just point out that these final verses are written in what is called an alphabetic acrostic. An alphabetic acrostic. Anybody have an inkling of what an alphabetic acrostic is? You know what an acrostic is. Here's the word joy, J-O-Y. And I've heard people use that to describe really a core issue in the Christian life, and that is that Jesus is first, others are second, and you are last. So J-O-Y. That's an acrostic. You're making an acrostic of that word. An alphabetic acrostic is when you take the letters of the alphabet and line them up and make words after them. So what we have at the last 22 verses of chapter 31 of Proverbs is an alphabetic acrostic. The person who wrote this took, for example, the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which is Ayin, Aleph, rather, and there's a word that worked to start that verse. And then the next letter, then the next letter, and it went through. By the way, do you know of any other places in the Bible where the writers did that sort of thing, where they took the letters of the Hebrew alphabet and did an alphabetic acrostic? This morning, in the first part of the morning service, when we started, I referred to Psalm 119. What's one of its distinctions, Jeffrey? It's long, yeah. It's the longest chapter in the Bible. And if you turn to that, you'll see that it's divided into 8 verse sections. I think it's 76 verses, 8 verse sections. And each of the 8 verses in each section begins with the respective letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Now, by the way, if that doesn't impress you, I mean, it does me kind of, but if I had to sit down and write poetry, and this is a type of poetry that we're looking at here, especially in Psalms, that's a challenge in itself. But can you imagine writing poetry where you do an alphabetic acrostic? And you have to take a letter and put it together. The old McGuffey reader, which was a standard for the instructing of American school children for years, used that and used acrostics and things to help them learn, and not just learn facts, but learn morals and biblical principles. In that. We won't go much further this way, but there are a few other places in the Bible. Book of Lamentations. Almost, I think, at least 4, maybe all 5 of the chapters, Jeremiah wrote it all in an alphabetic acrostic. So it's no small deal. Okay, here we are in these 22 verses now. We're going to start with verse 10. And just let me tell you, as we're starting into this, I want you to think about how you might summarize what it is we're going to read in these verses, okay? So without using the editor's notes, if you could think of a word or some words that would just summarize this, there we are. Okay, verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She's like a merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arm. She perceives that her merchandise is good, and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies sashes for her merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you exceed them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Okay, before we start looking more closely at each of these verses, if you were trying to summarize what we just read in those 22 verses by a word or several words, what might come to your mind? How would you try to do that? What's that? A pretty good woman. A really good woman. By the way, if nobody else adds anything, Dave gets the prize. So. Faithful. Yes. Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. One of the first things that jumped out at me when I was reading through it again was the word diligent. I mean, what are some of the old adages? No moss grows under her feet, right? I mean, this woman is busy. She's capable. She's worthy. She's a woman of character. And Debbie, I guess we have a similar note in our Bibles, but mine says the virtuous wife. A lot of ways to go about that. You know, it may be that this is one of the all-time favorite passages for preachers to preach, especially as you come close to Mother's Day. And I was thinking about that again recently. If I were a woman, much less a mother, and I knew that on this Mother's Day, yet again, the minister had chosen this passage and was going to be preaching from it, I might be tempted to stay at home. Because, I mean, what is being presented to us here is such a huge paradigm of measure of a woman. I mean, to look at that, you think, good night. I mean, she lights her candle at both ends. She gets up early in the morning. She stays up late at night. She meets the needs of her husband and her family, and she runs a side business, and she, from her profits, she buys real estates, and she plants a vineyard, and she still finds time to reach out to the poor and the disadvantaged and all this, keeping up her spiritual disciplines and her relationship. You know, it's tough enough to be compared to such a person, be measured that way. In fact, look at how the passage begins in verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife? And I think a person could well say, yeah, good question. I mean, if I'm looking at all that you've just written here, who can find a woman like this, a virtuous woman? Does such a woman even exist? And the answer, by the way, that we're meant to draw from this is yes, she does. But I want you to notice the second half of verse 10. And this is a help for us. For her worth is far above rubies. Now, here's a question for you. Why is it that something like a ruby is valuable? It's rare, yeah, and it's precious, yeah. It's rare and it's valuable, right? When you look at this, you know, rubies, precious stones, precious metals do exist, don't they? And they are valuable precisely because they are rare and they're a quality. In fact, let me just add one more thought here. These 22 verses that talk about what it is that makes a wife so valuable are made all the more significant if we accept the fact that they're being written by who? Do you remember? Since it's in the book of Proverbs, my thought has always been, and I read it and I went right past it, I thought, Solomon's writing this. And he might have. But when you start chapter 31, these are the words that King Lemuel, the utterances that his mother taught him. I'm gathering that she had a part in this. Okay? So, because she's not only a woman, but a wife and a mother herself, she knew from experience what she was talking about. So, it's interesting the way some of the translations begin this passage. Verse 10, who can find a virtuous wife is the New King James Version. The ESV, an excellent wife, who can find? The NIV, a wife of noble character, who can find? The ASV, a worthy woman, who can find? If you would, turn over to the book of Ruth for a moment this evening. Old Testament book of Ruth, that's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. If you remember the story of Ruth, you'll remember that from the beginning we're introduced to this woman who, even though she was not ethnically a Jew, she wasn't a member of God's Old Testament community, still she's a woman of unusual character. When her mother-in-law Naomi's husband died, and then each of Naomi's two sons who had married Moabite women, Ruth being one of those, died as well. And Naomi is preparing to leave Moab. She's learned that the famine that had forced them out of Israel has now subsided. She's ready to move back to Israel. She appeals to each of her daughter-in-laws who are still with her and encourages them not to go back with her. Don't leave your native land. Stay here in Moab. Stay with your people. And while the first daughter-in-law eventually did that, do you remember how Ruth responded? Look at verse 15. Naomi said to Ruth, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. Go with her, Ruth. No hard feelings. Go on. Verse 16. But Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts you and me. And so Ruth went back with her mother-in-law. She goes to Israel, which for her, understand, is a foreign land. I don't know if any of you have been out of the country for very long. It just crossed my mind to mention this. The first opportunity I had to spend a long time in a foreign country was going to France. I went as a single and spent the summer there, and the very few people spoke even broken English. So it was a real cultural challenge for me. In fact, by the end of that summer, I was given an opportunity to go to Scotland. Any place where they spoke English, I was happy to go. And I went and could barely understand it too, but nevertheless, it was English. But it was a huge challenge. Those were just a few months in France. Here's a woman who has left her country, her culture, her people, and she's gone with her mother-in-law. And from the very beginning, she proves that she's an incredibly diligent woman, and she displays all sorts of wonderful character. In fact, it's obvious that she came with Naomi not for what she could get out of it. In fact, let me just insert this. It wasn't because she heard that Israel had a great welfare system and that would provide for her security and, you know, minimal effort she and Naomi would be taken care of. That wasn't it at all for her. She went to serve, to care for her mother-in-law. In fact, it's really astounding as you see all this unpacked. Turn over to chapter 3 with me. And this is the backdrop that chapter 3 is taking place here. Jeffrey, would you do me the favor of turning this down just a little bit? My notes are going airborne. And there's a place for that, but not here. By the way, in chapter 2, just to fill in a little more here, you may remember the writer tells us how it happened that in the providence of God, as Ruth went out during one of the harvest times to glean grain among the reapers. In fact, now I need to stop a minute and explain something. Did you know that God, I mentioned that Ruth did not come with her mother-in-law from Moab to Israel because she heard that Israel had a great welfare system. But did you know that God had provided a type of welfare system for his people? I remember the first time this was pointed out to me, and it was really an eye-opener from several vantage points. In the Old Testament, when God established his law for the people, he said, when you are harvesting, for example, when you're harvesting a field, don't do a clean harvest. Leave the corners of it unharvested. If you're going along and you happen to drop a sheaf, you leave it there. You know, don't go back and pick it up. Don't clean the field. And you do that so that the poor of your people can come behind you and they can help themselves to what you've left behind. If you're harvesting the grapes from your vineyard, same thing applies. You don't clean harvest it. When you take the fruit from the tree, same thing. Now, there's a wonderful point in that. Number one, there's concern for those who are disadvantaged. And we're giving you an opportunity to supply some of your needs. But understand the difference in this to what normally the secular states have eventually come to. What we do today is simply give people something, and there's no exertion on their part to achieve anything. I didn't read this quote this morning. I mentioned it to somebody at lunch. Benjamin Franklin, who traveled apparently a good bit during his younger life, he was in France and other places, observed that in the countries where they provided assistance for the poor, the more they provided, the more the state did for the poor, the more the poor stayed poor. The less they did, the more the poor had an incentive to actually do for themselves, and they actually became better off. So the issue was not that you close your heart and you don't help someone, but what you do is provide for them so that they can do for themselves as well. So it's not that I give you something for nothing and you sit and you do nothing, all things being equal, but I make an opportunity for you if you really want some wheat, if you really want some grapes, you can apply yourself, and here it is, come and get it. So you got to get it that way. Yes. Yeah. I'd have to go back, Sandy, and reread that. I think the thing that stands out to me most is that there was a provision for the less advantaged, the disadvantaged, the less advantaged. But it wasn't simply a giveaway with no effort applied on their part. And I think that was a wise thing that was done. You know, Jesus said, look, the poor you have with you always. And by that, he wasn't justifying our not helping someone who's poor. But the reality is that's we live in a fallen world, and that's there. So how do you make the best of a bad situation? And I would contend that simply giving someone something for nothing is not the best help to them. One of the reasons we don't simply give money to people when they come by asking for assistance is the very obvious reason. Those people, you don't know how they're going to use it. For every one person that says, you know, I'm low on gas and I need money to get to my mother who's got cancer in Florida or whatever, you know, the stories you hear. you know, for every one that's actual, you're going to have a bunch that aren't. And they just know how to fleece people and do it. So, kind of got an aside on that, but for what it's worth, I thought that's interesting. So what's happening is, it's harvest time in Israel. Ruth has gone out to glean in the fields. So as the harvesters are going through, they're cutting down the grain, and they're tying them up in sheaves. She, along with other people who are less fortunate, are coming behind them, and she's gathering up the loose grain that she finds on the ground. She's putting it away. And in chapter 2, we're told how at a lunchtime, a man named Boaz, who we're introduced to as a kinsman, a near kinsman to Naomi's family. He was one of Naomi's husband's near kinsmen. This is his field. And in God's providence, she's gleaning right there. And so he comes in, he greets his workers, and he notices Ruth because she's a foreigner. And he says, who's that? And the foreman said, oh, that's Ruth. That's the one that came in with Naomi when she came back from Moab. And she's been here gleaning with us all day. She had to relieve herself. She was excused at one point, but she's been here gleaning all day. And when Boaz learned who she was, he said, you stick with my harvesters, and we'll protect you, and you come along behind. And he ordered them, in fact, to drop a little extra for her and help her out because of that. So Ruth's continued gleaning through the several harvests. It's coming to the end of one of the particular ones here. And since Boaz is a near kinsman, Naomi's family, or Naomi rather, counsels Ruth in the first four verses here in chapter 3 how she should approach Boaz to let him know that she's available. And by the way, this is a cultural thing, and you'll see why I say that as we read this. Verse 5, Ruth said to her, all that you said to me I will do. Verse 6, so she went down to the threshing floor, that is, Ruth did, and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. She came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. By the way, this is why I said this is a cultural thing. This isn't a justification, by the way, for single women to go crawl in at the feet of the bed of the man that they're interested in and, you know, make themselves available. Verse 8, now it happened at midnight that the man was startled and turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, who are you? So she said, I'm Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wings, for you are a close relative, that is, a near kinsman. Verse 10, he said, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, and that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you're requesting. But notice, for all the people of the town, my town, know that you're a virtuous woman. ESV says, all the people of the town know that you're a worthy woman. The NIV, a woman of noble character. It's interesting. John MacArthur, in a footnote here, says, in all respects, Ruth personifies excellence. And he ties this back to Proverbs 31, verse 10, because the very same Hebrew phrase is being used here. This is the same language, by the way, that was used of Boaz back in chapter 2, verse 1. There it's translated that he was a man of great wealth, but it's more likely that he was a man of valor. He was a man of noble character also. Are you getting this picture? So really, it makes this match between Boaz and Ruth a very significant match. This is a good match. Why? Because they are both man and woman, people of character. In fact, when I read those notes of that MacArthur wrote, I thought myself a good question that somebody who was single and looking to marry would do well to ask themselves is, or that I might even ask them, do you want, if you knew the story, do you want a man like Boaz? Then you need to be someone like Ruth. Do you want somebody like Ruth? Then be somebody like Boaz. Right? I mean, rise to the occasion. Now, let's go back to Proverbs 31 again. Somebody could say, well, what if the person that I'm married to isn't there yet? I mean, I'm already married, and they're not there yet. And when I think of the wonderful picture that Lemuel's mother is painting for us here of this excellent woman, this excellent wife, in fact, when I read the rest of God's Word, of men and women who experienced, or whether were exceptional examples in their own generation of godliness and diligence and character and so forth. In fact, when you look around today, and I think all of us from time to time bump into individuals that strike us as being people of character. It seems to me there are two possible responses we have when we're with people like that. And one is to become envious. And to, you know, in terms of scholastics here, you are in a college classroom, a high school classroom, and there's always one or two people that are really smart. And so if your professor is grading on the curve and that person's in there, guess what happens to everybody else's grade? Because they're up the top of the class, when you're graded, your grade is much lower. And you're tempted to say, hey, why can't you just be like the rest of us? You know, tone it down a little bit. Let's just be normal here. That's one way of doing that. But another way, another possible response is to take it for what it is and admire the person for the talents they have, but in this case, for the character that they've developed. And here there are people that aren't content just to be like everybody else, just to be average in life. Instead, they've applied themselves. They've made sometimes the tough choices, which includes denying themselves of different things and rolling up their proverbial sleeves and doing the hard work to be better than average. And actually, in doing that, and we're speaking now in terms of what the Scriptures are teaching, the goal is that we become more like God originally designed us to be. Before Adam and Eve fell, He designed us to be like Him. And when we're born again, when we're brought into the family of God, Paul says that that is my goal for your life. That is God's goal for all of us, to be made Christ-like. And so that's the goal that's there. Now, by the way, just a comment of personal application here. I'm finding myself more frequently these days when I'm praying, whether it's for myself or for other people, rather than simply praying the generic, well, God, would you bless so-and-so? I know they're having trouble in their marriage, or I know that this is going on, so would you bless them? I'm finding myself praying much more specifically in light of the standards and the examples that were given here in Scripture. In fact, I'm asking God to help me personally become, helping others to become what it is that God has spelled out in His Word. When I'm thinking of husbands and wives, there are some very specific passages. Ephesians 5, 1 Peter 3, and ladies, for here's the extending passage that we're looking at right now. But the whole point is that Ruth and Boaz were a good match precisely because they complemented each other because of their respective character. By the way, getting a little sidetracked here, but I'll try not to go too far. It's interesting, over in chapter 18, Solomon said, "He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord." And that's very true. But remember, there he also gave a number of other passages and warnings, really, about getting connected to the wrong person. Here's chapter 21, verse 9. "Better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman." And there are just a bunch of those throughout Proverbs that we've read together. The whole idea is that it's worth waiting, it's worth finding the right, in this case, wife, but husband and wife. In my, I've got a file on the book of Proverbs that I've been keeping for some years, and I found an article in one of the old Worldwide Challenge magazines. That's Campus Crusade for Christ magazine. We still get those here. I'm not sure what year it was printed, but a gal named Marcia Hornick who had graduated from the same Bible college I did a few years before me. She had married a man who became a pastor. He was pastoring a church in Utah at the time. They had six children of their own. But she wrote an article entitled Clothed with Strength and Dignity. And she took this passage. And as she approached these 22 verses, it was an interesting take she had. Rather than reading this as a snapshot, these 22 verses, here's a snapshot of the excellent, energetic wife. She wrote, really, it can also be viewed as a lifetime photo album of a woman who fears God. And I thought this was an interesting take, because the temptation is to look at this and see it exclusively as somebody who has already arrived. And she's saying, yes, here's somebody who has arrived by the end of their life, but what we're seeing is snapshots throughout her life as she's progressing on and becoming. And isn't that realistic with life, whether we're a man or a woman, in our walk with the Lord? That is, when I came to faith in Jesus Christ, what happened at that very moment was very real. And my sins really were forgiven. And the righteousness of Christ really was placed to my spiritual bank account. And I really was adopted into the family of God. That happened, and it could never be changed again. But I tell you what, I was a whole lot different then than I am now. There's been a huge change in my life. And if God gives me any more years, I would trust that the same thing would be true. In fact, that is normal if we're a Christian. There is a change. There's a progress. And so as we're reading this, and ladies, I just want to put myself in your shoes, if I can do it this much, and say, as you read this, rather than looking at it, I had a dear friend who would read passages like this or be compared to another gal who was excelling in a certain thing, and they would feel so inhibited and so withdrawn. Rather than take that stance, look at it and see it as a thing to shoot for. This is a wonderful goal to shoot for and to strive for, rather than to push away from. So here we are, verse 10. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. We're reading a summary statement here that's meant to introduce what's coming. So like a rare, precious gem that increases in its value as time goes by, here is a woman whose character, her abilities, keeps growing as she matures. John MacArthur breaks these 22 verses into five compartments of this woman's life, and I think viewing them this way is going to be helpful as we go along. So let's try the first one tonight, and we'll pick up some more next week when we come back together. First one describes her marriage. Verses 10, 11, and 12. Read them with me. Who can find a virtuous wife, for her worth is far above rubies? The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. I don't know if there is a particular word that strikes your mind as you read these three verses, but the word that jumped out at me again, this past week, as I was reading through them, was the word trust. First part of verse 11, the heart of her husband safely trusts her. And if that doesn't mean much to you, maybe it's because you've never had a spouse whom you could not trust. And I hope that has not been the case for you. It's not that any person is beyond temptation, but this woman's husband didn't lie awake at night wondering if maybe there was something going on. Was she going to stay faithful to her covenant promises to him? When she went away and went out of the house, when he went away to work, he didn't hire a separate set of eyes to keep an eye on her and kind of keep an eye to see if she was rendezvousing with somebody and all this nonsense that goes on. When I was reading this past week, I remembered the sad surprise that I was given. I went back to the boys' school that I graduated from almost before the flood now, and became friends with the teacher. It was a small school. There were just several hundred students there at the best. And the librarian's son graduated a year after me, and Bill married soon after college. And when I went back, I asked how he was doing and his wife, and she said, oh, you didn't hear, and they had gotten a divorce. And I said, "Oh, Miss Pennington, I'm sorry. What happened?" And she took off with one of his better friends. And as we talked about it, the mother said, "You know, it just crushed him." And he came to his mom later and said, "Mom, I forget who the actor was. Some, you know, Hollywood always has its machos and the real, you know, ones that appeal to young women." And he said, "If she had gone out with him, I would have trusted her perfectly." So it was just a total shock. Here's a woman who gives her husband full trust. There's no occasion for distrust. But it's not only in the area of morals that this husband's wife is trusting. Notice, more specifically, in the second half of verse 11, we're told her husband safely trusts her so he will have no lack of gain. What's this about? See, he can trust her with the family finances. He can trust her to manage the household income and not go off on spending sprees. To do, as one man wryly said years ago, to buy stuff we don't need to impress people we don't like. Right? You know, she's a woman that understands the value of a dollar. She doesn't have to get her financial fix by running off and doing that. I remember talking to a husband a while ago who was just about at his wit's end, and basically he couldn't do that with his wife. He finally came desperately and just took the checkbook, took the credit cards, hid everything. If it wasn't nailed down, he wasn't sure that it would be there when he got home. Well, in contrast, verse 12, she does him good and not evil all the days of her life. This is just a part of who she is. John MacArthur writes, "This woman's husband doesn't maintain jealous guard over her or keep his valuables locked up so that she cannot access them, as was so common in the ancient practice of the households when there was distrust, but she demonstrates this impeccable loyalty to her husband, and her thrift and industry adds to his wealth." So what is it that this... Well, that's a good place to stop. Why don't we just stop there this evening? Any comments or observations as we do? That's right. You know, one of the things that's by the way neat about the Bible, in contrast to so many other religions, is that it doesn't paint an unrealistic picture of its people. You see them warts and wrinkles and all, and so the reality is there. So I like the realism of that. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for all of your word. We thank you especially for these verses at the end of Proverbs, and we pray that as we read through them that you'll help our eyes to be open, our hearts to be open, that we'll hear what you would have to say to us and glean from it and become more and more like Christ and rise in character ourselves to become people of excellence in this generation for such a time as this. We ask in Jesus' name, amen. And amen.